LeBron re-signs with the Lakers, but he is not taking a discount. Klay is moving to Dallas, and we explain why. We open up the notebook on other NBA free agency rumors, and we vibe check the second apron. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter from Yahoo Sports. With me, as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. What is up, buddy?
Jake, I don't know if you could tell wardrobe-wise, we're deep into summer vibes right now. The only thing that's surprising here is that I'm not all the way unbuttoned, not down all the way to the navel.
Take one down right now. Do it.
Take one down? All right. Well, there is an undershirt under here, so I've already established. I mean, listen, YouTube audience, you're going to have to start paying for this stuff. If I go undershirt with chest hair popping, we're going to have to start, charging for this.
No cap room only fans starting next season.
Dark times. But, listen, sometimes that's where you wind up in the offseason, the doldrums of the summer. But we have moved from the finals. You still have some confetti in your bag through the draft. And now deeply into free agency and the offseason proper. So plenty of stuff to talk about since the last time you and I talked, for sure. But also since the last No Cap Room and since Finney on The Good Word. So plenty to get into today on this summer Wednesday. Happy Independence Day, y'all, by the way. We're coming to you on Wednesday instead of Thursday this week.
Wednesday, July 3rd. Not always Wednesday, but July 3rd is my parents' wedding anniversary. So shout out Betsy and Peter, 38 years running. That's why I'm here with my mother's home office background and wearing Northeastern tees, that some knockoff Northeastern t-shirt that some family member must have gotten me when I enrolled in the school. And I'm digging through the archives of what I used to wear over a decade ago. And that is what the Lakers were trying to do with bringing back, and I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, okay, maybe the transitions need a little bit of work. It's been a little while since you were on the mic. Let's get back to it. It's all right.
Yeah, I had to. Thank you for guest hosting in my day off.
I mean, in between. Was your day off even a day off? I know you like wrote a big notebook that day. You had plenty going on.
I did. And then got back on the phones that night and got ready for free agency. And we're just going to go through all this shit. I made a brief appearance on the Dan Le Batard show Monday, but I haven't really spoken into a microphone about the NBA offseason, especially not with a co-hosting hero of
hard
my
posting. That's right. I post hard. It's exactly right.
So let's just dive in. We are going back to our intro segment. Five basketball news stories swinging the spotlight around the perimeter. And the first is the biggest, probably from a historical standpoint, the arguably greatest player of all time, LeBron James, is staying with the Lakers.
Thought you were going to go James Wiseman up top. But all right, no, we'll get around to him.
Wiseman's interesting. But yeah, LeBron going back to LA on a 2-year deal, not a 3-year deal. He was eligible for a 3-year contract because of the over 38 rule. You cannot sign a 4-year deal. So the 2 years is a bit surprising. The 1+1 is also LeBron's back in the year-to-year, hold the org accountable type thing. Plus a no trade clause is in there. But I think the big story here is that LeBron opted out of his player option and definitely told the Lakers. Our sources have confirmed that. He told the Lakers that he'd be willing to take less, and significantly less, if they were able to get someone of a certain magnitude. I've heard various names, from Brooke Lopez to Jonas Valanciunas, I don't think was the guy LeBron wanted to take a pay cut for. But I love
the idea that he was on the list. It made me feel really happy to see that Jonas's name got in there with the other with Hall of Fame guys. Oh, that's wonderful.
And you know what? Jonas Valanciunas is going to make sweet, sweet money being the starting center for the worst team in the NBA for a couple of years. So shout out to JV.
Absolutely.
He got paid. But yeah, I think when LeBron and his clutch camp communicated this, the goal was to get a dude. And I think the dude of all dudes for them, being that Paul George was not in play for roughly $20 million in salary. Obviously, he signed for a 4-year max in Philadelphia. It was Clay. And like the moment Clay decided to go to Dallas, and look, I think Dallas is where he wanted to go ultimately. The fact that you've got his father who still is affiliated with the Lakers organization in some type of broadcast role, whether it's TV or radio, I'm not 100% certain. I apologize. But Michael Thompson again going out on Sirius XM and saying how disappointed he is that Clay didn't come home, didn't finish his and like there are people throughout the Warriors who I was talking to about this all saying like Clay's a West Coast guy, vibes, low key. Like, why would he go to Dallas? Like, why would he go to Texas? But you know, there was some. We'll get to Clay and the Golden State more. Let's keep it locked in on the Lakers.
Sure.
To me, all that's to say, LeBron doing this now, Wednesday, today, just kind of guarantees almost that LA is not going to be swinging some major move. Sure, they have flexibility to move D'Angelo Russell's contract and others to try to figure out certain things, but I don't really know if there's, like is DeMar coming and changing the world for the Lakers even? You know what I'm saying? So I know, and we have it in our rundown, that Brian Windhorst said on ESPN something to the effect of the Lakers and LeBron don't have the same priorities. And like yesterday while I was in between calls and packing up my room, and I put on a bunch of the different post-draft press conferences on YouTube, because sometimes you just pick up on something. It's just been so clear throughout JJ Redick's public-facing tenure now as the head coach, they just keep saying player development, player development, player development.
Yep.
They award Max Christie this contract, and it's hailed as a player development success story, even though Max Christie has not developed into anything of real consequence in Los Angeles right now. So, I don't know. It is just a weird, like, half-in feeling from LA right now, right? Is that kind of what you're getting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's reasonable to look at it and say, if you're not getting, I mean, Klay Thompson would have been a major help. You know, they're always looking for more shooters around LeBron and Anthony Davis.
Who isn't?
Could, right. You know, you could argue, you know, another big man, you know, whether it's Valanciunas or Brook Lopez or, you know, a high level center who could, you know, maybe take some of the wear and tear off of AD, let AD play more of a roamer role on defense. Like, you know, he's forever sort of have in that push and pull of meet your best position and the way you're most effective for us is at the four, but at the five rather, but maybe you're more comfortable playing the four. You could argue something like that would raise their ceiling. But I think it's reasonable to look at it and say, you know, this team, this roster as constructed was not good enough to get out of the first round, or maybe could have been good enough against a team that was not the Denver Nuggets, but didn't get out of the first round. So what is the move that's going to get you there? And then if that one wasn't on the table, then what are you going, you know, I don't think there was one home run swing. So from LeBron's perspective, you look at it and say, it's kind of a free roll reputationally to go, I will take a pay cut if we can make a big, you know, but only yeah. if we're really raising the ceiling of this team, because that's, I believe in this team enough that where I will take a big pay cut. And, you know, how serious an offer that is, I think depends on who you talk to. I know Ramona Shelburne and her sort of big Clay exit from Golden State postmortem this morning had it that it was going to be, he was willing to do something significant enough, and they were looking to make moves enough to offer Clay something in the area of like 4 and 80, which is a big, you know, it's a big number and significantly above where he wound up with Dallas. So you can argue that, right? You could say like that might have, maybe that was a real thing, but if it doesn't pan out, okay, well, you get to go back and say, well, then in actuality, I will take my maximum salary. Thank you very much. And also, I will take a no trade clause to make sure that I just have the maximum control over the situation. And I will take a player option so that we can do this all again next summer and I can exert as much influence as I can. Like when you reach LeBron James's level, obviously, you just whatever, you know, sprinkles and, you know, cherries on top of the sundae you can get. You get all of them, and you look to, I mean, the value you can create is in control. So that's the level that he's operating at right now. It's the level he's operated at for most of his tenure in the NBA, certainly the last 15 years or so. When he wants long-term, he signs. When he doesn't, he keeps its options open. So in terms of where the Lakers can go, I think it's worth noting. I think it was Woj reported this morning that there's the structure of the deal, at least as we're recording right now, has not yet been finalized. Potentially still a conversation happening with Rich Paul and the Lakers on like maybe going a little bit below the max to maintain some roster building flexibility. But
he can help them, just quick interruption. He can help them by taking like $1 or $2 million less so that the Lakers can be under the second apron.
And that will be, and we'll talk more about the second apron later, but the that's important from the perspective of like, you can still aggregate salary and trades, right? Like not, they would still be up against certain restrictions, but not all of them. And so that that would make potentially grease the skids on some other transactions. And so maybe, you know, staying below as you mentioned, trying to find a way to make a deal for DeMar DeRozan happen. But if, you know, depending on what DeMar DeRozan is comfortable accepting, that's a big question. If he does, if they don't get to that pathway to adding somebody new and he stays at the max, that basically takes the mid-level exception out of the running in all likelihood. Keeps, if you're over that second apron, which they would project to be above that $188.9 million second apron, no more adding guys and sign and trades, limited basically to like minimum salary deals and maybe re-signing Taurean Prince. That's kind of where they would be at. So then the question is, where do you, how do you create flexibility? Otherwise, it means getting off money. And so to me, I think the interesting question from there, and you know, I don't know how much you are hearing on these things one way or the other, is like, what is out there for a like D'Angelo Russell who opted into his contract, or for Gabe Vincent, or for Rui Hachimura, Jared Vanderbilt, these guys who are on like mid-sized deals that if you could move them into somebody's cap space, then yeah, you open up some flexibility and some ways to add. But at this point in the free agent calendar, in terms of who's available still and who's not, and who's out there with cap space to import these guys and what the Lakers might would have to attach to do it, like it's a pretty tricky needle to thread, no?
For sure. Especially, I mean, there's only a couple teams out there that are open for business in terms of trade into our space and give us a couple picks to do that. Gabe Vincent, I think, you know, depending on the team, has more retrade value than others. D'Angelo being an expiring contract is something. I mean, I've been hearing since February that the Nets would be open to taking him back. And someone told me that as recently again, that has been a conversation this week. So that's all I really know. The other stuff I think is just like exploratory. Like you just call teams and say, hey, would you take this guy? Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And they're at 15 guys on the roster now from a guaranteed contract slot. So like anyone they'd have to add, someone would have to go out the door. So we'll see. I mean, we spent a lot of time on the Lakers, so let's just kind of to put a bow on all this. News has also broken while we've been recording that Bronny James has signed his 4-year, $7.9 million rookie deal. That's one of the other 15 guys on the roster. And as JJ Redick said in that interesting player development themed draft press conference, he is not going to be on the summer league sidelines because he's putting together his staff. I thought was curious. I think like Steve Kerr, for example, not coaching whatever the event was at the FIBA AmeriCup or whatever it was in between being announced as Team USA head coach and going out to Manila, like in hindsight after they didn't medal, it was like, well, why didn't you do that? It was in like August. Why isn't JJ Redick just taking the free opportunity to stand on the sideline and do the thing he's never done before? But he's saying it's because he needs to be putting together a staff, which the whole league will be on the ground, myself included. My official dates, July 12th to the 17th. And I don't know. I mean, the news just came out that they have hired Nate McMillan and Scott Brooks, two former head coaches, to be the top assistants on JJ Redick's staff. Scott Brooks' name we definitely heard and had said previously on this show. Nate McMillan was around the Pistons a little bit last season. His son was their G League head coach underneath Monty Williams' staff. He was taking a year off and doing stuff with the foundation. I remember there was like word he was going to get hired midseason to be some type of consultant. And I called him. He was like, nah, taking the year off. So he's back. And the Lakers have a rest of a staff to figure out, and we'll see what else happens in their rotation after LeBron comes back at a top max dollar figure and not the pay cut many people were wondering.
Speaking of not pay cut, one last thing. This deal officially moves him over $500 million in career on court earnings, which, you know, I don't know if you know, that obviously just nice work if you can get it, but also if you're talking about, you know, the people who have maximized their value in this environment in a max salary slotted sport and in a sport with an increasingly hardening cap, you know, can't look past LeBron James there.
For sure. Yeah. The last thing, because I really do think it's so tied to Clay. In the early aftermath of him like choosing Dallas, I was texting someone who would know, and they said, yeah, I don't think LeBron's going to be willing to wait that much longer for this to go down. So I really do think Clay was kind of the apple of the pay cut eye, and it didn't happen. So it didn't happen because he chose the 3-year, $50 million deal with Dallas. That is item number two of our five opening segment here. Dan wrote about the vibes on the court from a playing style standpoint and how he could fit in Dallas and what have you. I'm just going to say this. You got to give credit to Nico Harrison's front office with Michael Finley taking Luka's beer and recruiting guys and their cap expert, Andrew Baker, assistant general manager, Matt Riccardi. Like, so many teams in this league, I think, operate from a standpoint of trying not to lose instead of trying to win. And that's such an adage that I think you learn in like middle school basketball that is hard to hold up, admittedly, when you have $4 billion franchises and legacies on the line and what have you, and all this public pressure and people like you and I who don't know what's happening exactly in the room telling them that they're doing their job in that room badly sometimes.
Sure. Right.
I get all that. But like, the Mavericks, by various accounts from my reporting, were going all in on getting KCP from Denver and bringing back Derek Jones. That was why they moved Tim Hardaway Jr. We talked about it when I was sitting next to all the confetti in the very immediate aftermath of Dallas's loss. That was their move, and they did. They sent Tim Hardaway out to Detroit. They bring back Quentin Grimes. But then, depending on whose perspective it was, what happened with KCP, I don't know the exact accounting because there's different perspectives, but KCP opting out and testing free agency all but ended the Dallas approach of him. And Derek Jones changing his representation from the guy he was with from the second he was an undrafted player and helped him, you know, throughout his whole career, Aaron Turner, leaves for Rich Paul at Clutch Sports, files the paperwork 4 days before free agency begins. And technically speaking, unless it's negotiated between the two agents, you must wait 15 days for your next agent to be able to represent you. And in this new era, this new second apron CBA, where you can negotiate with your own clients, like, Derek Jones's contract was all but done with the agent who he fired. And it kind of just created this super thorny situation where they weren't basically able to bring Derek Jones back. That's all I can really like say definitively publicly that I know to be true. So Dallas, what do? They go out and they sign Najee Marshall, someone that we had written was a backup option for them. And they figure out a way to sign and trade for Clay. And the sign and trade for Clay sends out Josh Green, who you could absolutely argue Quentin Grimes might just be better than. I don't know if that's true. The Knicks basically said he's off limits in any Donovan Mitchell trade talk with Utah 2 years ago, and then sent him out the door to Detroit for Bojan Bogdanovic and Alec Burks. And then Detroit's just getting off him so quickly. So how good is he? We'll find out this year when he's in a contract year and he's in a real, you know, contending situation. But Dallas just got better, and they just made the finals. And I'm curious for how much better you think they got, particularly because of the Klay Thompson addition.
Yeah, the I think the enduring image from the finals to me was just how, like, so how many wide open shots other Mavericks got that they couldn't make. And that because as the series went on and Boston was just, Boston began the series saying, we are going to force Luka and Kyrie to create one-on-one. We are going to hug up on all these guys on the perimeter. We are not going to let them move the ball at all. And then as the series went on, they were emboldened a little bit more and more because whenever those guys got their opportunities, they were clanging them. And so then by the, you know, as it went on, you were just like loading up behind in front or between Luka and the rim or Kyrie in the rim and saying, all right, Josh Green, go ahead and beat us. Dante Exum, go ahead and beat us. Maxi Kleber, go ahead and beat us. Derek Jones Jr., go ahead and beat us. Well, one of those guys is now going to be Klay Thompson. And Klay Thompson, for, you know, the myriad ways in which he has completely understandably lost a step at the NBA level. Dude couldn't walk for like 2 years. Yeah, I mean, he missed 2.5 years of his prime. Like, he was, I think, 28 when he tore his ACL. And then was, and then, like, in, you know, and
it was really long. 2019 was so long ago. Holy shit.
It's more than 5 years now. And he was at the peak of his game, like 30. He had just scored 30 points in 31 minutes in a finals game and then got hurt. And so, like, one of the things that I think, and this is maybe not like a, I don't know if it's a hot take or not, but a thing that I believe is true, is the fact that he's even back to the level he is at now is like one of the best stories in recent NBA history.
It was a guy at the 22 finals, like him being not just there and healthy in the rotation, but like a fucking contributor.
Yeah.
Was a lot. I mean, I remember being there game three and just being like, man, Klay Thompson's Klay Thompson. It's pretty cool.
It was tremendous. And so anyway, all that to say, the much of the postmortem reporting about Klay's exit from Golden State has focused on sort of how that deteriorated. And I think that there's something to be said for the looming specter, like being out from under the looming specter of you are never going to be who you were again. And you had this ownership essentially stake in what this became. You were part of the foundation of this dynasty. You will never be that guy again. And Steph still looks more or less like that guy. And Draymond Green, when he's on the court, often looks more or less like that guy. And Klay Thompson just didn't. But who Klay Thompson still is one of the highest volume, highest accuracy catch and shoot 3-point marksman in the NBA still, like at a level that 95 or 97% of the NBA cannot reach. And somebody who is a movement shooter in a way that once Tim Hardaway Jr. got out of the rotation, Dallas just didn't have a guy like that. So it became much more stagnant. It became much more isolation-based and one station to station. This could crack some things open offensively. I think the concern is on the defensive end, as you mentioned, and we've talked about this a number of times before. The Mavericks didn't really take off last season until after the trade deadline. And then even further than that, about a month after the trade deadline, Derek Jones Jr. goes back into the starting lineup with Daniel Gafford, with PJ Washington, and the identity of, we're like a pretty good offense, but we're an awesome defense. Mm-hmm. And then that carried them. I think they were 29-12 from that point through the end of the finals, and were the top two defense for the rest of the regular season, won those playoff series, the first three playoff series, largely with their defense. Mm-hmm. Klay Thompson's not Derek Jones Jr. on that end. And if Klay Thompson's starting, then that means Najee Marshall isn't, or Quentin Grimes isn't. And so then you are losing something at the point of attack. Now, all of a sudden, PJ Washington's got to be your top stopper, like maybe a tougher sell when it comes to opposing guards. So I think the recipe shifts. And I think that's the calculus that Dallas is making, is we were like, from the end of that last 20 games, that last 25 games, whatever, we were like a above average offense and an elite defense. And I think what the math now shifts to is like, let's be a top five offense and see if we can be a top 10 defense.
Yeah.
Which is basically the Nuggets math. And, you know, you build everything around your shot creators and you go from there. It can work. I think there's definitely some stuff for Jason Kidd and Sean Sweeney to figure out, but Klay being paid to be the guy he is now, as opposed to constantly fighting to reclaim who he was before, I think might be like a overarching net positive just for his state of mind and the way he feels going out onto the court. So I think that there's a possibility for a real positive improvement there for him.
Yeah. Look, Klay Thompson is going to score over 20 points a game during the regular season. Tim Hardaway Jr. was putting up like 18 and was a leading sixth man of the year candidate for the first couple months. So all he has to do is stand there. It's also like it could extend his career. Like he's not going to need to fly around screens and always do all this motion stuff because Kyrie and Luka command so much attention. And if they want to, Luka can just dribble on over to the left wing and do a little handoff and then park his ass 15 feet extended. And if Klay doesn't have anything, he can just drop it down. Like there's so many things they could do with this guy that we don't even need to get into it because we've got other stuff to talk about. But to me, it's just such a hand and glove fit in terms of they just needed, like you said, someone who can make a fucking wide open shot. So yeah, the other big thing is like Klay, as I wrote in our reactionary column at yahoosports.com, that he was going to come off the bench in Golden State this year. That was their plan. Maybe they would have started him from the jump and they would have made Brandon Podziemski like, quote unquote, earn it. But the overall plan from all angles on this, I have been told, was that was the plan. And like him to just go to Dallas, even if he is the sixth man in Dallas, then he gets to be the microwave scorer off the bench and everyone's going to love it. In Golden State, everything he walked and talked and did was going to be a story. I remember being with Golden State in Atlanta the weekend before the deadline, and then they were in New York that week before. So I got to kind of like follow the Warriors for like a three game road trip, basically. And he got benched at the end of the Nets game, and Anthony Slater doing his job, the great beat writer for The Athletic, like walks up to Klay post game and is like asking him about what it's like and how hard it is to sit out the crunch time moments. That's not going to happen in Dallas because there's no history of him being this heroic late game, you know, firecracker. And it's going to be such a better existence for him. And as someone who I've never like gotten to know Klay, but I feel a kindred spirit with him in many respects. I'm just happy for the guy that he's going to like get a fresh start and turn the page. Sometimes that's just what people need and organizations need. And he's going to get that. We're going to get a not fresh start in Cleveland because item three of our five out is Donovan Mitchell's long-awaited extension is there. 3 years, $150 million. After they went out and hired Kenny Atkinson, a large part of the coaching change and the hire was definitely to get someone in the door that would have supported Donovan's efforts to stick around. One interesting note is that it's not the 4 year with the player option that people have talked about. It is a straight 3 year deal and there's a player option in year three of that. But the whole point of the 3 years is to get him out back onto the market at the 10 years of service where you can get access to the full 35% max contract that will become eligible to him. And like now the rest of what Cleveland does from here is going to be, I think, simple, like maintaining. They have been maintaining all throughout the summer. Now Spurs call for Darius Garland, not interested. Hang up. Like the Pelicans want Jared Allen. You know, they're trying to figure out Brandon Ingram stuff. The Cavs like Brandon Ingram, but we're not giving up any of our core four. Click. Like, I don't really know how much more business is coming in Cleveland. I wouldn't say it's going to be anything substantial. That's just my read on it right now. Things can always change. But right now, and throughout this whole offseason, ever since Cleveland lost in the playoffs, it's been about changing the coach, figuring out ways to maximize Evan Mobley, and they are not trading any of their core four. That's been their tone. That's been their message. They've stuck to it. Jason Tatum also not going anywhere, as we all expected. 5 year, $314 million, which is one less than $315 million that he was eligible for, which I don't have that 100% confirmed, but I have been told this is pretty dope. Do you know what 314 is, Dan?
I'm going to guess his St. Louis area code.
There you go.
Yes.
Pretty sweet move. And that's like, there's this kind of St. Louis fraternity in the NBA world. You know, I think the tip of the iceberg, the most visual of those guys, the Bradley Beal, Tatum, Drew Hanlon crew. and they have their all their people that are following. Big moment for St. Louis. So yeah, I think the most important Boston item, item four of our five out segment here, is Wick Grosbeck, the majority owner of the Celtics, announcing he's going to sell his stake in the team. The last sale we had in Minnesota went a little sideways. still undetermined.
Right.
This, I think, though, you know, Gabe Plotkin and Rick Schnall bought into Charlotte as minority owners first. They had a right of first refusal before Michael Jordan would have sold it to any entity. They buy the team at large. Steve Pagliuca, to my knowledge, who I was talking to post-game in the locker room, nose-to-nose, dripping sweat. Like we were in a club.
Sounds weird.
We talked about it last time. It's a callback joke.
It's not a joke. It's a callback fact. But it does sound funny. I agree.
Yeah. That's why I said it. I would suspect that this will not be like a dramatic changing of the baton here. But the timing is pretty interesting, being that they're about to have the most expensive basketball team known to mankind, the history of the universe. Yeah. And it's not getting any cheaper anytime soon. And the second apron stuff that we keep alluding to that we're going to fully dive into at the end of the show is only going to make it more challenging and more expensive. And the repeater tax is coming and blah, 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 blah. So pretty sweet to go out with your second ring, hang it up. And also his initial investment of $360 million. I mean, I don't know what his exact percentage is, but the Celtics are at least tenfold more expensive than what. And I think, honestly, with where they're positioned right now, with the history of the franchise, and this is just total educated speculation. I have not called an investment banker or anyone who specializes in this space as to what they think the price point is. But like, there's no way to me this thing selling for less than five. And that would obviously set a whole new precedent for sales, because I don't think anything's approached or eclipsed four in the last couple of years. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all unfolds, but also more interesting to see if once the dust settles, the new ownership makeup will be as committed to this current group to pay to support a champion, because of course this team looks as positioned as any to compete and compete and compete, even though this is the age of parity and the new landscape is supposed to encourage that. And the Knicks got better. The Nets did not get better.
No.
The Sixers got better. And the offseason is still young. Who's to say what Milwaukee and Miami can still do? Cleveland certainly thinks that with a year of growth that they will be one of the better contenders. Orlando got better. So there's not to say that the Celtics are going to have another cakewalk through the East again. The Pacers, in theory, should continue to grow. But it's a very interesting time for Boston to be potentially changing hands.
Yeah, a couple of numbers on that. One is, I mean, in addition to the Tatum contract and the fact that Jaylen Brown last summer had signed the largest contract in NBA history, now supplanted there, the Celtics this week also extended Derek White, 4 years and $126 million. They brought back all their reserve bigs, Luke Kornet.
They're expected to work on a Sam Hauser extension too.
Yeah, so like Luke Kornet, Xavier Tillman, Namias Quita, Namias Keita, I think is how you pronounce it. And then, picked up Sam Hauser's option, may extend him off that. We will see about whether or not they bring back O'Shea Brissett. But they're basically bringing back the entire roster from last year with adding
Run
Baylor Shireman.
Run it back.
Yeah. And then bring in a first-round pick Baylor Shireman on a first-round picks guaranteed deal. All of that puts the Celtics in line for something like, I mean, obviously next summer, there's going to be the Al Horford question. And like, you know, there will be more roster spots to fill in next summer. But just with the guys that they know are going to be around for the 25-26 season, they're in line to pay an estimated $230 million with still some roster spots to fill. And then with the higher luxury tax rates, as you mentioned, the repeater tax, that would put them in the ownership on the hook for nearly $500 million in total spend for that season, not next season, the one after. And so the fact that they do those deals, they sign those extensions, and then right away it's basically like, and the team's for sale. this might be a get out while the getting is good kind of time. The pessimist in me, and you know, you and I talk often about my pessimism, I do wonder, there's part of me that's like, well, all right, the Bucks guys got out, MJ got out, Cuban got out, the Celtics guys are getting out. I'm like, is this one of those, like, all the rich guys are figuring out how to colonize Mars while our planet dies type situation? Like, is this, we just got the TV deal done, let's cash out now, because we have a concern about the health of the league moving forward. But that, again, might just be my pessimism. Maybe it's just a simple fact of, like, when Forbes values your asset at $4.7 billion, and that might be low, maybe a good time to get out while the getting's good.
Yeah. Our last item on Five Out, the big man in the corner, James Wiseman, 2-year deal to join the Pacers. Still only 23 years old. According to our rundown here, only 2 weeks older than Lakers rookie Dalton Knecht, although one of them is a fluid athlete and can shoot a basketball. And the other.
Hey, listen, you never know. You know, James Wiseman going to Indiana, maybe he's the new Miles Turner in a year or two. Who knows?
Maybe so. Maybe so. It's just him being in the news again, and he was going to find a spot. Like, there's still enough that you see that is going to reserve his opportunity to be in this league for at least a 2-year deal, 2-year minimum deal, I would imagine. I don't know the terms of that. I haven't checked it. It's just him. He is more emblematic right now to me of, like, some of the misdoings of Golden State trying to pivot in the post Kevin Durant era. And I hope for him that Indy being, like, his next home and not just, like, the place that he got discast from Golden State to be, like, part of the Detroit, whatever the hell they were doing the last couple of years rebuild. He's not just, like, in a reclamation front court room with Marvin Bagley and others. Like, great, arguably the best point guard in navigating pick and roll and feeding the big man that we've got in the league right now, and Tyrese Halliburton, the Miles Turner stuff you said. So we'll see. We will see if he can be rehabilitated into something more. But yeah, it's just another kind of weird Golden State thing that this offseason has kind of been.
Yeah, I mean, the tying up that loose end makes a lot of sense. And I think for Wiseman, the issue, like, he was also a guy that maybe was pretty adversely affected by, I mean, not that the pandemic didn't adversely affect everybody, but he played, what, like, 3 games at Memphis, and then that was the pandemic through the 2020.
I'm going to steer hard the opposite and say it helped him because there was some still mystery intrigue of him being.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know if he goes number 2 if he plays a full season at Memphis and people see what he has been since.
Okay. I'm talking about from a development perspective, like, he barely played and then the mm-hmm. league didn't exist and he didn't have a, training camp. And then all of a sudden he shows up and he's supposed to be the starting center on the Warriors and play like their super specific style that it was not at all what he was supposed to be. Right. So
I think a ring though.
He did get a ring and, you know, you can't argue with that. But I mean, it's in terms of finding finding himself as an NBA player. Detroit, not an optimal situation for that either. I think that the say, you know, walking in here with, like, you are, yeah, you're still the number 2 pick and you're going to carry that forever, but, like, you are a minimum salaried third big who has to fight Isaiah Jackson for minutes and has to prove that you are a better option at some points than just going small with Obi Toppin and Pascal Siakam. Like, that is you're going to eat what you kill, and that's kind of it sort of setting for him. And doing that with Rick Carlisle, with the, and with, as you mentioned, the point guards that they've got with not just Tyrese Halliburton, but also, like, playing off the bench with TJ McConnell, playing with Andrew Nembhard. Like, there's guys that are going to be able to set him up. I love our friend Caitlin Cooper at her Patreon basketball. She wrote, had a great line about this, which was, for a player who needs to be fed, the Pacers have plenty of silver spoons.
Oh yeah.
And I think that's the way to think about it. Like, if James Wiseman's going to find a way forward, this is a pretty good opportunity for him to do it.
That will do it for our Five Out segment here to open No Cap Room. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more after this.
Welcome back to No Cap Room. I'm Dan Devine, and I'm talking now because I'm taking the mic away from Jake Fisher. This is one of those times a year where the NBA rumor mill gets really ramped up, and that means it is time for us to crack open the People's Notebook, as kept by the People's Insider, and see what Jake Fisher has been hearing as he spends all day with his iPhone glued to his ear. Jake, I want to start...
Don't do that. I put AirPods in because I feel like there. I feel radiation in my ear when I put my phone in my... Do you feel that? It freaks me out. I don't like that.
I hear you. I mean, no, honestly, what it made me think of just now is like, have you ever listened to Radiation Vibe by Fountains of Wayne? It's a pretty good song. It's a really good summer song. They're a really good summer band.
John Gennaro, count me in!
That's exactly right. We'll find out if where we're going to be counting in again at some point soon, maybe. Jake, start me off with your earpods in and your iPhone somewhere else on Lauri Markkanen. He seems like the biggest name that sort of popped up in these discussions in the aftermath of some of the big names in free agency. Where are we on the Utah Jazz shooting star?
So he's definitely been on the list of like, go get a guy for Golden State. And I think the Sacramento Kings, to my knowledge, earlier this week were close to a deal. I do think that based off of conversations I've had.
Really?
I do. I can't say more than that, but there were calls made to people around the NBA that would have indicated that talks have been legitimate there. And it just, look, like we've written about this, Utah was in a very similar situation to Brooklyn with Mikal Bridges, trying to find someone to bring in to pair with that guy and start this thing to start the arrow pointing back up towards championship contention. And they didn't. And then instead, they got a massive offer from New York and shipped him out the door. So that sets a really nice benchmark for what Utah would want for Lauri Markkanen.
Well, wait a second. You mean to tell me that Danny Ainge might set a high bar based on a previous transaction? That doesn't sound right.
Yeah. And like, look, I've still been told that Utah prefers to keep Lowry and renegotiate and extend him. They can't do that, though, until August 6th. So why not spend the next month fielding offers and telling the Kings, yeah, we'd do it if you give us Keegan Murray, and tell the Warriors, yeah, give us 3 picks and pods and whatever. And, you know, San Antonio is another team I keep hearing is on the periphery there too. They just got more picks from Minnesota to give up that eighth slot. Like it doesn't hurt to listen. I still don't think he's going to get triggered. As someone told me, Justin Zanuck, the GM of Utah, told them, there is a 10% chance that Utah is conducting their business with a 10% chance they're going to move him. But you're telling me there's a chance.
Yeah, right. I mean, 10% isn't 0 or 0.5. That's up there. And I know you can't necessarily say, for sure who's in offers and not. But what I can tell you is if I'm sitting in Danny Ainge's chair, yeah, Keegan Murray is the first name that I'm coming up with. And I'm also noticing that the only pick that the Kings have encumbered right now looks like it's still that 2025 first to Atlanta from the Kevin Huerter deal. So still plenty of first round equity going out to 2031 for the Sacramento Kings. So that would be a place to start, I'm guessing, if I'm Danny Ainge in that conversation. Another name we've heard connected to Sacramento in the rumor mill is Brandon Ingram. You know, you mentioned earlier, maybe there's not a direct line to draw from Ingram and his situation in New Orleans to Cleveland and their situation with Jared Allen. Are there any lines to draw on Brandon Ingram at this point that you're hearing?
I think so. I mean, I've been writing and saying and reporting this since before the draft, like from Kyle Kuzma to Zach LaVine, like the Kings are absolutely looking at ways from the Kevin Huerter, Harrison Barnes package and
which
whatnot.
Has been out there for like ages, right? That particular
for
package.
Sure. I mean, there are people I know who Kevin Huerter straight up said to them before the deadline, like, yeah, like I'm ready to get moved. Like I know what's going to happen. So it hasn't happened yet, but it's definitely been out there. And there are plenty of teams that, I mean, Kevin Huerter does have value in this league. Like a contract right around the mid-level now. Shooter who can hold up somewhat defensively, can do some stuff off the bounce himself, like playoff tested guy. There is interest in him, but it's always tricky when you're trying to like upgrade to a certain level, load up. And Brandon Ingram, I think, is at a, you know, borderline all-star level that just like, I don't know necessarily if 2 50-cent pieces make a dollar in that scenario. It could, in theory, if you're like a rebuilding team that could then retrade those guys. Like if you're Portland taking back Malcolm Brogdon and Robert Williams and think, oh, well, we could just turn around and turn Malcolm Brogdon into something. As they, I mean, they paid more to go get Denny Avdia. We'll talk about that later. But yeah, I think the Kings clearly have a group and they have had a group of wings that they are trying to figure out how to get. Larry Markkanen and Brandon Ingram, I think, are either 1A or 1B or somewhere at the top of that list, because they are just by default two of the best players who have been, like, besides Paul George and Mikal Bridges, anybody else that's on the board, like, are they better than those two guys? I don't even know. And I don't even know if Mikal Bridges is as good as them. So it depends on the eye of the beholder there. So yeah, I think Sack's involved. But also, the Ingram stuff is a little bit different from Markkanen's, being that Markkanen, they have this, you know, month-long window before the August 6th renegotiate and extend thing. Brandon Ingram's been talking extension stuff, his representation with the Pelicans, for weeks now. And they're still trying to come to an agreement before necessarily getting to the – I mean, the trade stuff's definitely being discussed, but I think there's still also an opportunity for him to extend right now. They could do that in today, in theory, versus, and that would take him out of trade talk for a little bit. Larry Markkanen will be someone bandied about and teams will call about through the month. And especially, like, look, the Utah Jazz were not trading Donovan Mitchell all summer, even after they traded Rudy Gobert, you know, 2 years ago. We all go to summer league, executives meet, they rub shoulders, they try to be seen sometimes in the stadium to have the rumor mill think even maybe something is happening. Oh, if David Griffin is meeting with Monty McNair and it's seen, well, then maybe other GMs will see that and feel like they have to pounce, or Danny Ainge talking to whoever about Larry. And like that summer 22, I remember I was literally at the airport waiting to board my flight to out of summer league. And someone texted me, hey, like Donovan is, it's a thing. Like he's on the market now.
Wow.
And it started like it that stuff can. So I just say all that to say the offseason is still young. It seems like free agency is winding down, which it is. But yeah, once everyone congregates in Las Vegas, there will absolutely be opportunity to stoke these coals. And that's also like a week away. Who knows what could happen? But right now, I think those two guys are absolutely two guys to keep an eye on, and keep an eye on for Sacramento in particular.
You know, it's wild, and or maybe this isn't wild. It feels wild to me. Which one do you think is older, Lauri Markkanen or Brandon Ingram?
I would think BI.
He's like 4 months younger. He's May 97 or he's September 97 and Lowry's May 97. So like it just feels, and I think part of it is like we just sort of forget about the entire Chicago portion of Lowry Markkanen's career at this point. It's like he kind of didn't exist before he became an all-star in Utah. But Ingram, a somewhat tricky fit because of the contract reasons, as you mentioned, the idea that you're going to need to extend him, that he's at like a, you know, fringe all-star level at this point, but also somebody who operates primarily in the mid-range, seems most comfortable at that part of his game. Another player with a similar sort of profile at this point, although dramatically older and further on in his career, DeMar DeRozan, also has the Chicago connection going back to mm-hmm. Lowry. We are now at a place where it seems like a lot of potential lily pads for DeMar DeRozan to jump to in free agency are gone. What are you hearing about the Bulls all-star guard, where he might be able to move from here on out?
Well, just a quick thing, because a thought just popped in my head. The DeMar DeRozan sign-and-trade that sent him to Chicago, the Spurs were in on bringing Larry back then. So it should not be a surprise that they are one of the teams calling right now, especially being that they have one Victor Wembanyama in the front court.
No one, any team that's in on Lowry Markkanen, it should not really be a particularly big surprise, because you're like for 7 foot movement shooter who's like in his prime.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you don't have to envision ways he can fit. The shooting and the size makes him fit pretty much everywhere. Some of these other guys a little bit trickier in terms of the volume and the accuracy and the willingness to play in that role.
The other thing, too, is I reported Minnesota. I saw Mike Scott at Hoops Hype has reported Minnesota's interest in Lowry. A team calling and registering interest right now doesn't necessarily mean they're like trying to get him.
Sure.
It just means they're figuring it out to potentially understand the landscape for when the situation were to arise. So if there ever were a need for Minnesota to figure out something with Karl Anthony Towns, I'm just connecting dots out loud here. Right. It would behoove the Timberwolves to understand what the interest would be in terms of what Utah would need back. I'm not saying they're talking about that at all. I'm just saying, in theory, you got to get your ducks in a row. Same thing with Philly. Like I wrote in my article that Lauri Markkanen was never someone that the Sixers were like looking at to be this third star right now. That became Paul George. But I've also been told since that article came out that the Sixers do have interest in him for the next time he were to actually become available, or if he were to ever become available, and it made sense for their team to go after him. So I wanted to clarify that. To DeMar, we're kind of in a similar situation where he was when he signed and traded to Chicago, where Lowry almost got involved in that, because there was all this talk about, maybe the LA teams, and both. I was reminiscing with this with someone with the Clippers in my conversations about all the Paul George stuff over the weekend. Like, both LA teams were hopeful that DeMar would be willing to take the mid-level or even like something as small as the biannual to like take a hometown discount and come on home.
Does not seem to be something that DeMar DeRozan is particularly interested in.
No. And like, there's been all this word that DeMar would be a top backup option for the Clippers if Paul George leaves. Like, I was advised by someone that I trust who's in the situation that like that was not an option for the Clippers. And like they were thinking of ways to open up at least the taxpayer mid-level. And they got a way to get it to all the full mid-level to bring in Derek Jones. They didn't use all of it, right? They still have that $3.3 million left or whatever it is. And there's some opportunity for Chris Dunn to come via sign and trade that still is yet to be determined while they're figuring out Russell Westbrook trade stuff too. We're really going all over the notebook right now off the top of my head. To bring it back to DeMar, I think he is arguably the biggest piece still on the board. There has definitely been some talk of potential double sign and trade of him to Miami and Caleb Martin back to Chicago. I have not gotten that confirmed as like a serious thing that's being discussed, but people in the league have definitely talked about it. But outside of that, and outside of there being some type of sign and trade to the Lakers where D'Angelo Russell goes back and he can be a salary close to like the 20-ish that I think DeMar would like right now, I don't know where he's going. I don't think they know where he's going. I've been told that there's not really a rush either, that like teams are still figuring out all these, like the DeJounte trade is still incomplete and open-ended. The Mikal Bridges trade is still open-ended. All these sign and trades can be turned into 5 and 6 team deals to create trading player exceptions here and other stuff there to leave open optionality and flexibility for a lot of different guys. So where he falls still seems pretty undetermined right now. I haven't checked with anyone who would know about his situation this morning before we recorded this. So if something comes out today, my bad. But the last I heard as of last night when I went to sleep was that, I think a lot of these guys are being patient. But it does seem very, very clear that he's not going back to Chicago.
Yeah, I was going to say the only thing I feel like I can say pretty conservatively is that after the Caruso for Giddey trade, after re-signing Patrick Williams, after bringing in Jalen Smith, like Chicago is not an open door for him. So he's going to have to go find another one. And as you mentioned, I mean, like, if there's not an option that's there right now, there's no harm in him waiting. You know, you didn't find the first off ramp at the beginning of free agency. You didn't find that optimal situation. Give the market some time to play out. You can understand him saying, like, I don't want to take the mid-level, or at least the reporting being not, you know, he's not ready to move down that level. Like, he just averaged 24 points and 5 assists a game last year. Like, yes, he's going to be 35 years old, but he's clearly still got skills that are valuable in this league. Fourth quarter score, positional size is at the wing. Like, he's a guy who's a ton of playoff experience, tough as hell. Like, you know what you're going to get in him. The idea of finding a match in Miami makes a ton of sense to me. Remains to be seen whether they can do that. You know, you mentioned the Clippers as one potential, at least early hoped for option for DeRozan. A guy they've been connected to more recently, Miles Bridges. What are you hearing about the, I guess, now former, or at least potentially former, Hornets forward, what the market might look like for him?
And I think if you gave both Clutch Sports and Charlotte true serum, I think they both would say that their preferred scenario would be a sign and trade for him elsewhere. The Clippers would be that in theory. And the Clippers have also shown a absolute willingness to give guys second chances from
third
off
chance,
court stuff.
Fourth chance. Yeah.
From being the first team to bring Josh Primo back from like founded sexual assault stuff with exposing himself to team psychologists and whatnot.
It's got him cut from the San Antonio Spurs.
From Kevin Porter Jr.'s off-court stuff with a alleged domestic violence situation in a hotel room with his girlfriend that is far murkier than the Josh Primo thing with a he said, she said legal dispute that then
but
got...
But still an arrest on felony domestic violence charges.
Of course. Miles Bridges' own domestic violence stuff, you know, pled no... We don't know the necessary truth of all this stuff, but when you start adding them all together, and look, I don't know the quote, but Law Murray, the great Clippers beat writer for The Athletic, pulled something that Lawrence Frank said at some point in the past 6 months, basically saying, like, we're going to have to take chances on guys. And they clearly
are. Was fallen angels, I believe the term was there. And
there
that's,
we go.
I think that phrase could wind up coming back at the Clippers in a pretty significant way if this is the direction they're going. In any event, like, that, you know, Kai Jones obviously had a, you know, pretty dramatic state of affairs in Charlotte, wound up with him out of the league briefly. He's getting another opportunity, or has he gotten another opportunity
LA
too?
I don't want to speak too much on what Kai Jones was dealing with in Charlotte.
Right.
But that is far more of a mental health, get yourself present and put your feet on the earth in a healthy manner than any of this stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're way right. That is not something we're talking about, a criminal offense or, you know, anything of that nature. But
yeah
it is the Clippers moving in some interesting directions. If not LA, have you heard any other potential options for Miles Bridges at this stage?
No, I mean, they were looking at Philly as a home for him in theory with, you know, a strikeout for Paul George option, and like, A, they didn't strike out for Paul George.
Yeah.
B, never was told that Philly thought he was someone they'd want to go after. Detroit, I was told, was not a spot. And like, they went out and gave their money to Tobias Harris, who they gave way more money than anyone else would have. If the Pistons didn't get that deal, 2 years, roughly $50 million to Tobias Harris, that dude was going to sign for the mid-level somewhere. But consummate professional, you got to reach the salary floor anyway. Tobias Harris and Jonas Valanciunas are the two got to reach the salary floor before training camp winners of free agency. Shout out to those guys.
Solid vets. Yeah. You know, people, you know, got to love a solid vet on the multi-year deal. Another solid vet also with ties to the Philadelphia 76ers, most recently employed by them, Buddy Hield.
Yes.
The most recent discussion that I believe we heard was Tuesday night, the moving toward a sign and trade with the Warriors. What can you tell us about Buddy in Golden State?
I don't have anything updated since my tweet I put out about 10 minutes before we recorded. But the word then was that the agreement, the actual contract agreement between Buddy Hield and the Warriors has not been finalized. It's kind of the opposite of the Klay Thompson situation, where Klay and the Mavs agreed to their deal, and then the Warriors were like, all right, let's figure out this trade now. The Sixers seem to be of the mind that the deal is in a holding pattern until Buddy and Golden State can finalize their number. And at first, I got a tip last night, like, oh, Moses Moody going to Philly. I was like, whoa, that'd be a big win in theory. But not the case. It does sound like it will just be Buddy going into a traded player exception to Golden State, which then allows Philly to not take back any salary and therefore not be hard capped at the first apron. And they'll probably get back some type of second round capital similar to what Golden State got back for Klay Thompson. And the Sixers gave, I think it was 2 second-round picks to Indiana, two or three, whatever it was, at the trade deadline to get Buddy Hield. So they'll essentially be bringing back the capital, some of the capital at least, that they sent out to try Buddy out in this never-ending mix and matching role players around Joel Embiid in the playoffs. And I mean, I knew Buddy to be one of the people on Golden State's list of guys they thought would be willing to take part of the mid-level and what have you, depending on how things broke out. So I'm not surprised, but I think that also, if you're looking at this from a, we were trying to make all these huge moves and our answers to losing Klay Thompson and Chris Paul, even though like both those guys weren't world beaters, they were, you know, very valuable contributors to that organization. I think it's not a bad overall return. Like Kyle Anderson, DeAnthony Melton, and Buddy Hield are veterans and pros, and they've been there. Buddy only made his first playoff run this year and was basically a non-factor before flamethrowing in the final game for Philly. But Kyle Anderson's been, you know, he was in the Western Conference Finals last year, deep playoff runs before. And DeAnthony Melton was a huge piece of turning Memphis into like a real threat in the West. His back, though, is just a question mark. And if he's healthy, he'll be absolutely worth it. Interestingly enough, he's the only guy to sign for the full med level so far this year. So that's like something just to keep in mind, because I remember I went on Nate Duncan's show before this all started, like Friday, I think, before it all started, maybe 2 Fridays ago. Yeah, it was before the weekend of what would have been Game 7 when I had a wedding. So it was before the draft, the Friday before the draft. And I said, I'm skeptical for the, you know, middle class of the NBA. I don't think any of these teams want to give the full mid-level out. And that's really been the case. There's been one. It's been Golden State. So to get Kyle Anderson and DeAnthony Melton and Buddy Hield, in theory, all with only one of those guys getting the full mid-level, because you can only give it to one person, I do think it's pretty good work. It's just a little bit of an underwhelming return for all this stuff.
Yeah, I think if the upside of a team where you bring back, obviously, you know, Steph and Draymond, you know, you bring back Gary Payton II and Kevon Looney, you bring in Kyle Anderson, DeAnthony Melton, Buddy Hield, you've got year two for Brandon Pajemski and Trayce Jackson-Davis. Like, there's Andrew Wiggins, obviously one of the biggest sort of men of mystery in the league at this point in terms of what you can sort of anticipate and expect from him. You know, Jonathan Kuminga, Moses Moody, like there is a pathway here to a pretty good team. And if the Warriors were already like at best a pretty good team with what they had last year, this is now a pretty good team that does not cost them luxury tax dollars. And so I think that's the idea moving forward, right? At least for right now, for ownership. Like, we've paid a ton of money in the luxury tax for years to compete for championships. We don't think this team is competing for championships at this point. So let's reset the repeater tax count for us. And we'll, you know, try to be as good as we can and see what our optionality looks like. But I think for right now, that's probably as far as they're going to be able to go. And now I think that's as far as I'm going to be able to go. Jake, take the mic back. I'm getting kind of tired of hosting.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate you setting me up for a bunch of shit. And now we're going to call this quick. We got 2 more segments left. We appreciate everyone rocking with us. But as a consumer of podcast media the last couple of days, I feel like I want to just listen to two dudes rambling about all this stuff, because there's not going to be much to talk about from mid-July on. So let's ramble and unspool thoughts while we can. But let's keep this.
Do you feel like we haven't been rambling for most of the last year plus at this point? Like, do you feel like we've been a real focused, narrow cast podcast?
I think people want the back and forth. They want the unplanned. They want the off the cuff. They want the Danisms. And
oh God, please don't tell me there's a list of those someplace.
I've been keeping a mental one for sure.
Oh no.
And I say them to myself every night. When I close my eyes,
I don't like any part of this. I want fewer instances of you imagining things I said before you go to sleep. Anyway, Jake, set us up for another segment.
This segment we're calling "Who's This Guy?"
It's a great name for a segment.
I wanted to call it "Who's This Guy?" Who's this guy?
Sing whatever you want. That's fine by me.
In the tone of New Girl. Who's that girl? It's Dan. So we gave player comps for Paolo Banchero. We asked Dan to give some comps for my rec league championship performance.
That's right.
Oh, I just knocked something off my mom's desk. I don't know what that was. It'll be okay.
Who's that guy?
Today, just to help members of the NC Armada who might be a bit of a casual, we are going to help.
Big 10 here. All welcome.
All are welcome. Come on board. Sail these choppy seas with us. Crack open a canned seltzer. Have a time. Today, we have each picked one player that has switched teams in free agency. And we're going to give some comps to help you better understand what is coming in the door. So Dan, who's the guy that you want to say a bunch of silly stuff about?
It's Isaiah Hartenstein. if the parameters here are switch teams, so one of the main guys that switch teams, I don't think you guys need a whole lot of comps for Paul George. You're probably pretty familiar with his game across the board. Isaiah Hartenstein goes from the New York Knicks to the Oklahoma City Thunder, 3-year, $87 million deal. Huge, huge payday for Hartenstein. And I think that fans probably became a little bit more familiar with his game in the playoffs during the Knicks' run through the first and second round. Mitchell Robinson's hurt. Isaiah Hartenstein is starting, playing a bunch of big minutes. Guarding Joel Embiid, playing a huge role offensively in the second round against the Pacers as the rest of the Knicks all atrophied and died.
Left-handed floaters aplenty.
So many floaters. The goal here is like who. If you were trying to envision his game, let's think about it. And so I have a bad brain, so I like to frame these in the form of jokes. So here we go. The lowest of keys, healthy Bill Walton.
Okay, I see it.
Useful Nurkic.
That's a drive-by.
Which, I mean, it's mostly because his name is Yusuf, but useful Nurkic. These last couple, I think, are going to maybe bulge some eyes out, but we're going to go with it. Not Victor Wembanyama, but like Ty-er Wembanyama. Might not be a bona fide win, but like Ty's pretty good. I guess it depends on how much you like your sister. But like, and then the last one I have here is either indoor voice DeMarcus Cousins or bound and gagged DeMarcus Cousins.
Oh my God. Indoor voice is a little not NC-17 version of that one.
It's a little quieter. That's the reason that I bring it up. And so the reason that these are the names.
You compared him to Victor?
The reason that these are the names. Here is a list of guys who have averaged 15 points, 15 rebounds, 5 assists, 2 steals, and 2 blocks per 100 possessions for a season. So not like overwhelming scores, but like reasonable scores.
Yeah.
Hammering the glass, able to move the ball, get their hands on in the passing lanes, and also protect the rim.
I'd be curious. This is just something to think out loud.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see. Because the other stuff is great, but just the 5-assist, 2-block group would be an interesting one.
Yeah, I would imagine also not particularly large.
Yeah.
But that list is not very long, and it's a bunch of Hall of Famers, right? So there's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Charles Barkley, Kevin Garnett, Vlade Divac, Anthony Davis, ooh, I think, on the trajectory to get there.
Vlade Divac is a nice name for Hartenstein. Right? Really, I mean, good one.
Now, not the flair as a passer, but like big guy who can move a little. I mean, you know, before Vlade got a little older in his career and he wasn't able to move as well, he was like up and down the floor. But from the elbows, dropping passes to cutters and stuff like that, which is something that Hartenstein has flashed in his game, did more of working off of Jalen Brunson in the two-man game and some of the Knicks and their dribble handoff stuff last season. That's a skill he brings to the table. A guy who was on that trajectory, Hall of Fame bound before injuries, was Boogie Cousins, where it was like, you know, a guy, again, there was a reason why after the injuries, Golden State wanted him to be a, you know, pick and pop big and an elbow sort of hub, why the Nuggets picked him up to be a backup to Nikola Jokic. Stylistically made some sense there. Who else had been a backup to Nikola Jokic before he got moved on and then wound up sort of elevating up in his career? Isaiah Hartenstein, stylistically, makes some sense there. And Victor Wembanyama. Now, obviously, I am not saying that, and obviously Isaiah Hartenstein also on that list. I'm bringing it up not because he's not on that list, not just because it's a cool list of names, but Isaiah Hartenstein's on that list.
I'm going to say a cool list too. Led Zeppelin, Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, right. Isaiah Hartenstein there as well. And so the reason I bring that up, obviously, he is not the offensive equivalent of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Kevin Garnett, Charles Barkley, Anthony Davis, Boogie Cousins, Victor Wembanyama. But you're looking for a guy who is a finisher at a high level, who can make plays with the ball in his hands, who is an elite rim protector. Hartenstein, I think it was 52.5% opponent field goal percentage at the rim last year. Top 10 mark among guys who defend a bunch of shots. Finished second in defensive estimated plus minus last year. Like, he is, has been, and was last year, an elite defensive center. So elite defensive center with ball skills who can pass. There are not a ton of those, and he is one of them. And so I think the interesting thing, given that, you know, is that Oklahoma City had, you know, they were a five-out team. They did not, they wanted their bigs to space. They wanted Chet Holmgren picking and popping. They didn't want anybody cluttering up the passing lanes. Hartenstein isn't a shooter like that. He did do some shooting in LA when he was with the Clippers, I think, but only maybe like 30 or 40 attempts, something like that. That might be part of his game. He might be able to sort of expand that in Oklahoma City.
Remember, but we said this is going to be a quick segment?
Jake, you spent about 45 minutes talking earlier, so I'm going to take the mic now.
Sorry to throw you off. I was just messing with you.
I'm done with Isaiah Hartenstein talk. I thought my things were fun and joyous
fun.
And ebullient, but maybe
they
not.
They were fun. So, I love Isaiah Hartenstein. I want to keep hearing more about him.
Well, if anybody wants to hear more about Isaiah Hartenstein, they can read Jake Fisher's story on why he was going to be the best big man on the market from May, because Jake saw this coming and he was exactly right. Hartenstein, huge addition for Oklahoma City. And I think bound and gagged DeMarcus Cousins is a pretty good comp.
Now I feel like a real asshole because you took me messing with you into turning it into a compliment and you killed me with kindness.
Well, what happened, I mean, that combined with a pop-up ad starting to play music on my computer, I think really sort of derailed that particular part of the segment, but it needed an off-ramp anyway. So let's head out of that into your player comp.
A pop-up ad and being at my mom's desk just flashed me back to a memory of being in high school. And when Anna Nicole Smith died, there was like a pop-up.
What kind of pop-up ad are we talking about?
There was
Jake?
Like a pop-up. Because it was back in the day, like before ad blockers and stuff. I mean, this was like 2008 when like the internet was, you could click two wrong things and a virus would pop up and your laptop was fried out.
That's right.
And I remember my mom being like, you were on my computer and you were watching porn. And I was like, what? I wasn't even in the room. And I got punished I was going to say suspended, but this isn't Adam Silver's office. I got grounded for going on a illegal website or an NC-17 whatever website when I didn't do anything, but I was a teenage boy, so the culprit was but anyway, I don't even know if that's something I should have said, but
methinks he doth protest too much. That's what
anyway,
I would say.
Anyway, my player comp, who's this guy, didn't change teams because of free agency. He was traded. This one, Denny Avdia, who's changing from the East Coast all the way to the West Coast. I don't know how many other franchises are further apart than the Washington Wizards and the Portland Trailblazers on the NBA map. So if Blazers fans usually be the opposite, like, oh, East Coast guys aren't staying up to watch the West Coast dudes. But if Blazers fans weren't getting out of work early at 4 p.m. to watch the Washington Wizards. Denny Avdia, it's kind of been like a personal favorite of mine for a little bit here because I was loving every ounce of the FIBA Euro Championships two summers ago that inspired me to pitch myself to go to the World Cup in Manila last summer. And watching Denny do like hero ball stuff for Team Israel was kind of sick because he wasn't doing that in the Bradley Beal era Wizards. After Beal gets moved out the door and for Chris Paul and Jordan Poole comes back and it's this kind of weird, like, what are we doing in Washington year? Denny took all these strides offensively that I know made him be a really valuable player that a lot of contenders were calling Washington about, to the point where, you know, the word is still out there that like it's roughly two first round picks or whatever that the Wizards want for Kyle Kuzma. Denny got moved for two firsts and Malcolm Brogdon's salary coming back. And like when that deal went down, a lot of people I talked to who said, yeah, I mean, well, we valued him more than Kyle Kuzma. So, I mean, he's a guy who this year upped his 3-point shooting to 37.4% and was whipping dimes. Just, you don't even have to watch the tape, just YouTube it. It's YouTube Denny Avdia highlights, and you'll see plenty of behind the back.
We'll see what kind of pop-up ads pop up. how angry various moms get.
Plenty of, the type of behind the back passes he throws are sometimes not suitable for work. He's got some over the head stuff going to the point where I'm giving him, who's this extra guy? I'm giving him Bambi Hedo Turkoglu. Because he's still figuring out how to walk, but he's a lock. I mean, the dude's a great defender, probably even better defender than Hedo's peak, which I will say is Israeli Nick Batum, if we want to go to an old Portland guy. And a thin, more bouncy Boris Diaw. It's kind of the mold I see him in. I see him as like a connective passery. He's not going to break you down off the dribble, but he can bring the ball up and sling some passes to the weak side corner. If the 3-point shot continues to progress, then like he's a real, real dude in this league. And Portland, I mean, giving up two first round picks for him. Part of that is also the fact that he's on a really great team controlled contract for the next 4 years that kicks in this year. And it's declining too. So it's like 4 year, roughly 48 million, I think, or 52, depending on the incentives and all that type of stuff. But it starts at 15 this year, then goes down to 14.3, then 13, then 11.8. So you tie all that together, really intriguing young player who's only 23, who goes to a situation in Portland where, sure, Matisse Thybulle is there, but they don't really have like a bigger wing who can guard up for four, up to fours, that like has room to grow on the offensive side of the ball too. When you've got this glut of Scoot Henderson, Anfernee Simons, Shaedon Sharpe, that I know you're going to take every opportunity to trade Anfernee Simons to the Orlando Magic that you can get, Dan.
I mean,
I love Denny Avdia. I think he'll be great there.
Yeah, the Magic don't seem to be taking that opportunity, which is fine. And maybe that, maybe that's just a question of how much do we value Anfernee Simons, which I think is quite a bit in Portland, and you know, how much would another team be willing to give up for him, which maybe not so much. Bambi Turkoglu is a very fun framing.
That's the best
of that
one. That's the
I
best
like
one.
That a lot. Israeli Nick Batum, I think, is, but I think as a player type, yeah, like it struck me as funny because I was thinking like, oh, you're basically just trying to figure out like what French wing is he like? And then as you're describing like what he has turned into and what the potential he could become still is, I was like, this is sort of like the argument for why the Hawks took Zachary Risacher in the number one overall, right? It's like, this guy might not wind up being a superstar, but if he does like everything at a B plus or A minus level, that's a really valuable player that can sort of fit everywhere. And it's possible that Avdija
bigger,
is
better,
that kind
Thaddeus
of guy.
Thaddeus Young.
I mean, well, you know, bite your tongue. You know, we respect Thaddeus Young in this house.
I love Thaddeus Young.
I don't know that anybody's ever been bigger or better than Thaddeus Young. Thaddeus Young also had like the, it was during, I forget at what point during one of the disastrous early process seasons, but where he literally said in a post-game interview, like, I don't remember the last time we won. And it was just like the saddest thing in the world. It's like, oh man,
he gave
me
one of the best quotes in my book where he said that when Andrew Bynum, he like, there are all this stuff that came out, you know, like that he hurt his knees bowling and whatever and blah, blah, blah. There's one story that went unreported that Bynum, because he had like a gravel road by his house, he had a setback taking his trash out, and the Sixers heard about it. And Thad Young went up to Bynum and was like, yo, big man, like, do you want to play this year? And Bynum was like, And Bynum, and he said, how much are you making this year? He was like, I don't know. He's like, no, how much are you making this year? And I was like, I don't know, $18 million. He was like, pay someone to fucking take your trash out. It was so great. It was so great. And I was sitting with him in the lobby of whatever that hotel is by Madison Square Park on like 23rd and Lex. A couple teams stay there every so often. It's, I think it's called the Edition Hotel. I'm drawing a blank, but I think it's that. And it was like 10 years removed from that. Like, I was talking to him probably 2019. And that happened 2011, 12. So 8, 9 years removed, whatever it was. And you could just see Thad Young still being like, come on, Andrew Bynum, get your shit together. Anyway.
Well, I mean, we're going to need to hear a significantly higher level of quote from Denny Avdija to put him in that bigger, better Thad Young conversation. But generally speaking, player type wise, I like where your head's at. And I don't think, but I don't think any of them were as good as bound and gagged DeMarcus Cousins. I'm so sorry. No.
All right. We need to get out of here, but we need to also do our favorite segment. We're going to vibe check, but we're not going to vibe check a team. We're going to vibe check the second apron.
I feel a little bit bad like dancing about the vibes of the second apron because it feels like the vibes of the second apron are more funereal than like in the club, but all right.
Who's dancing is anyone who wants parity. Anyone who wants teams like Golden State, like the Clippers, like the Warriors, who typically, I mean, sorry, I said Golden State, Clippers, Warriors, Nuggets, I meant to say. The Nuggets are not a typical.
You just really meant it for the Warriors.
Yeah, I really meant it for the Warriors. The Nuggets are not the typical, oh, we're just going to pay the tax, it doesn't matter. I just want to click, because the Clippers put out this statement stating the CBA 17,000 times as a reason why Paul George was not going to be going back to the Clippers. And I've heard many esteemed colleagues in the media kind of, and people online for sure, being like, man, what an excuse. Like, second apron, boo-hoo, the Clippers, blah, blah, blah. I think the general NBA public needs to understand what the second apron really means. And it's not the, okay, you're barred from aggregating contract. It's not just that. It is all that in one respect. The barred from aggregating salary and, I mean, all that stuff. It's the fact that we wrote about this a couple weeks back. People are going to, I think, my educated guess is that the league at large is going to come to the just like we talk about second nights of back-to-back so colloquially, and going 2-for-1 at the end of the shot clock. Teams have to go 2-for-5 now. And what I mean by that is you can only be in the second apron for 2 years out of a 5-year window, or else that third year you get the worst punishment of all, getting your pick 7 years out in the future frozen and moved to the back of the first round. And it can't change. It is done. Like, once it's frozen, it is frozen there until you have a 5-year window where you were not in the second apron for 2 years in that 5 years. So with the Clippers in particular, my understanding of the situation with the Paul George trade talks with Golden State, you know, I've heard plenty and seen and read plenty of Golden State saying like, well, we made offers. Draymond Green said on his show that the Clippers just didn't want to help Paul George get to Golden State. Well, if you look at it from the Clippers' perspective, first, with Paul and them not wanting to go above 3 years, there would have been optionality for them to figure out, because this all starts now. So 24-25 would be year one. 25-26 would be year two. 3 years from now, the third year of Kawhi's extension, what would have been the third year of Paul George's deal? Uh-oh, now you're in the frozen pick. You know, you're out of the two out of five, you're in three out of five. There would have had probably some optionality in that final year to get out if they needed to. James Harden only signed a two-year deal. So, that being said, the Clippers wanted to do that because they didn't want to go all in for these guys who were 34 and then be stuck with them retiring after these 3 years, be stuck the next 5 years with no optionality at all, their picks out the door to Philly in certain years there, and then also have their next pick that in theory would help them like frozen and be like a pretty bad team. You know, the post KG Paul Pierce Celtics without being able to trade for all the picks to restart this thing. And when you bring it to Golden State, why would the Clipper, because Jonathan Kuminga, to my knowledge, not on the table. Like, this is when Golden State was trying to figure out how to do stuff with Chris Paul, and they've been talking about Wiggins things and, you know, Gary Payton opts in and Kevon Looney's deal and blah, blah, blah. And there would have had to have been some other chicanery for Golden State to get under the apron, which they could have done by just waving Chris Paul, to be able to aggregate salary anyway to make that type of stuff happen. But like, from the Clippers' perspective, to my knowledge, they had no interest in taking back the same amount of salary for Paul George that would have kept them in the second apron hell that they were trying to avoid with Paul George, but just with worse players. So Golden State, again, this is just my third party objective reading of the conversations there. An oversimplification of it was just Golden State trying to say to the Clippers, well, you don't want to lose them for nothing, right? And the Clippers were kind of like, yeah, we rather would than take back all this other stuff that's still going to hamper us moving forward and be worse than if we had Paul George. So that 2 out of 5 thing is something that I think fans need to really wrap their arms around. Because you look at like Minnesota, part of why they're trading their 2031 pick, the only pick they have access to for Rob Dillingham, is because Mike Conley's deal expires after the first 2 years of this 2 out of 5 window, right when Mike Rudy Gobert's will as well. And then they will have Rob Dillingham 2 years left on his rookie deal after those 2 years. It's all going to be a game of musical chairs of trying to not be in the apron for 3 out of 5 and just 2 out of 5. So that, to me, is the aspect of the second apron that people have not recognized and fully understood, particularly about the Clippers, but also in general. Everyone, rightfully so, looks at all of the punishments from the lack of aggregation ability, the lack of exceptions. You can't take back a dollar more in trades. Can't use traded player exceptions, all that type of stuff. But like, it's the 2 out of 5 frozen pick thing too that I think puts like a bookend on the jail cell. Like, if you are willingly paying into the second apron, you are giving yourself a jail sentence. But then if you also go for that third year in the 5-year window, you are then agreeing to a end date of your prison sentence instead of saying, oh, well, we can also do these things to barter our way out anytime we want. And that is the most punitive element of the second apron that you saw the Clippers deal with and run away from. The Nuggets is a little bit more of just the, yeah, we don't want, like, we're stuck, we don't want to, blah, blah, blah. But from the Clippers' particular scenario, and other teams will make these decisions, like we talked about Minnesota, trying to stagger their board to not be in that 3 out of 5 year thing. That is something I really wanted to underscore here.
Which is the system as it's designed? And so, I mean, the point of the system is what it does, right? So the idea is this is going to make it so that your super wealthy ownership groups can't just say, well, screw it. Yeah, fine. I'll pay whatever financial penalties I can. Who cares? Because it will still have access to doing kind of whatever we want. I guess the question that I have is like, it's because everybody's sort of responding to this like, well, I don't know what you want us to do. It's like all of the owners, like this didn't come from the players, right? Like the owners are the ones who were saying like, let's put in these sort of more draconian restrictions and like, let's do this for the purposes of, I guess, greater parity leveling of playing field. Like, so to that, for the league writ large to then sort of turn around and be like, well, I don't know what you expect us to do. It's like, well, I mean, the goal here was, I guess, just to greater dispersal of money and talent.
It's also like you're playing a board game and you're cranking up the volume on like the All Madden, you know, like those are two different mediums of game.
Right.
But, you know, you're trying to make the rules harder to have it be a more compelling team building, be a more compelling and competitive challenge, which I'm kind of on board for in one respect. I do agree that like it's kind of a similar thing with, you know, the debate of college and NBA and continuity and blah blah blah, and the one and done killed college. Like that, there won't be a way to quantify the player movement challenges that will present teams from like a chemistry culture relating to our fans. We've been building this thing, but the league has seen there be general business positivity from player movement and people talking about it. And we got a day out of Klay Thompson changing teams. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So this will definitely encourage that stuff. And it's like, oh, instead of playing checkers, we're playing chess, you know, thing. Shout out Kevin Booth. But yeah, it's not necessarily helping teams. It's just giving everyone a harder problem to solve as opposed to helping everyone, to your point.
Sure. And so this is a segment, at least theoretically, that's about feelings. And so I think one thing to keep it, or the NBA is going to do what the NBA is going to do because it is an organism and a business that is aimed at, you know, driving attention and maximizing profit. And these are the means that they have found to do so, that they believe that this is, as you mentioned, like emphasizing the transaction cycles, like building each of those into like a summer blockbuster event at several times of the year as a way of driving interest and engagement and stuff like that. Like I get it. Obviously, we benefit from that pretty dramatically. Mm-hmm. I wonder if, and maybe it's just the adjustment period and transition to a new way of understanding things, that like, as people look at it and go like, I don't understand what the hell this thing is and why it exists and why I have to, like, as I'm looking at why can't my team bring this guy back, or why can't the team that I root for sign that guy, because in 7 years its pick might get frozen. I wonder if that aggregates or redounds to eventually like a negative experience from a fan perspective of, I don't like, yes, we get excited for who we can sign, but yeah, we got a day out of Klay Thompson signing with Dallas. A lot of that from my perspective was we got a day out of Klay Thompson leaving Golden State.
For sure.
Because he mattered there. And like, for that sure. Is a relationship that I think we are unlikely to see very many of moving forward. Because the prime mover
in Golden State. Isaiah Joe and OKC, baby.
Maybe. I don't know. But like, the prime mover in Golden State is Stephen Curry. And maybe Stephen Curry gets to be the one guy who's there forever, right? And maybe you get your occasional ones of those. But the other guys that are also there for the balance of their careers, like that. Those guys matter a lot to people and to the way that we have, as individual, like human beings, emotionally experience the lifetime of giving a shit about these teams and what happens to them, more than just like sim to end. Did you win the championship? So I understand, like, if we want to use the All Madden comparison, like if this is a league that's about do the owners and executives have the hardest problems to solve, okay. I don't think a lot of people follow the league that way. And so I'm interested in like what the actual like emotional experience of following a league where this is the way the rules go, how that what that'll mean for people and how they will relate to it.
That's a great point. I mean, we have to get out of here, but I'll say this, like the CBA isn't created for the fans.
Yeah.
And maybe that's something that should be more considered moving forward. And this is not me saying, I think it's too early to tell. Like just with the lottery smoothing, like even though we're now at 5 years since the 2019 was the first lottery with flattening is the more
the flattening used the word. Odds.
We've seen crazy jumps. We've seen the worst team still get the number one pick. Like, I think the jury is still out on like how that has been. I think the jury is still out on like what the impact of this will be. Overall, I will say, as I have been discussing like the landscape of the league from like a television product standpoint, as the TV deal was such a talking point throughout the last year, I think everyone who's making decisions about the overall structure of the NBA business landscape would be better served if they thought more about the NBA as a television product, as the reality TV show it is, as something that they're trying to get people to engage with more, just like how Bravo builds out a universe from Vanderpump Rules and their Housewives stuff, where like you've got my girlfriend and her friends like paying tickets to go to a live podcast taping with like guests of these shows, and Ariana from Vanderpump emerging from the Scandoval. She's like the lead of a play on Broadway. Like, I know the challenge is that these players make $70 million now, and it's hard to get them to lean into being like as close to WWE characters as they can be. But like,
see, I don't think that's the right.
We gotta go.
I don't think that they need. It's the issue is like they need to be a reality show stars. I think that the issue is like if they're wearing seven different uniforms in the space of a 15-year career, it's hard to get emotionally invested in them the same way that you used to, that fans for the whole life of the league have been able to. So I think that's the stuff.
Yes.
And also like if the reason why I can't get emotionally invested in that guy is because we've come up with an arcane and complicated document that governs everything that makes it really difficult to understand, I think that is where you can lose people. So I wonder,
the 2-day draft was basically to help teams get their business done more so than I think it was from a television standpoint, because if it was, they wouldn't have done it at 4:00 in the afternoon from ESPN Seaport Studios to avoid doubling up and clashing with a presidential debate of two 80-year-old guys yelling at each other. So
I understand that the numbers are what govern the day and that feelings are not numbers. I just don't want us to completely lose sight of the fact that the feelings are why a lot of people give a shit about this. That's what I think should maybe focus on a little bit more.
And we appreciate you dealing with your feelings and listening to our feelings here on No Cap Room. We appreciate super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things to make the show look and sound great. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on, and leave us a 5-star review. That would be great. Enjoy the holiday weekend, everybody. We are off for July 4th. We'll be back next week, and we hope you stay with us here for another episode of No Cap Room.